Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM and streaming live from Viroqua, Wisconsin. You can go to WDRT.org and listen to podcasts of previous shows. And now we got a pretty good lineup of shows from Who's in the Kitchen, going way back at least 6 months, I guess. And thanks to my audience for tuning in, and we're on at noon every Saturday with guests about food in the Driftless area. So my guest today is my neighbor, Molly Doan. Welcome, Molly.
Hi, Philothea.
So Molly moved in like a couple of years ago next door to me, just the best neighbor, and really, you know, in every way. And she and Paul are becoming more and more grounded in the Driftless area. And Molly's been into gardening for a long time, and I've met her mom. Her mom's really into gardening, too. But Molly has just come out and just taken this piece of land and landscaped it so nicely, and is working on making a beautiful and productive garden. So she's been a real inspiration to me, and lots of fun to have next door. Plus, she's a baker, and so I just had this wonderful cake at her house, and I said, you got to be on my show. And she said, yes. So thanks, Molly. Appreciate it. But I think it really will be fun, because Molly is really a super, super baker. So one of the cakes we had was, the cake we had last night was a wedding cake. She called it a wedding cake. And so what actually makes a wedding cake? Lots of layers? I mean, what do you think of as a wedding cake?
Well, anything can be a wedding cake, mm-hmm. really. You could make a wedding cake out of anything that you love.
And well, just yeah, sure. Carrot cake or carrot chocolate cake or anything. Yeah.
Yeah, but this was like a classic weight cake from The Joy of Cooking. I think it's called the Lady Baltimore cake.
So okay.
If you have an old Joy of Cooking, especially like from before, say, 1960, which I do, it has all the classic cakes. So it's a cake you can expand infinitely, and you can, you know, make, you know, use a huge mixer and make a giant batch at once, and it will have exactly the same qualities, which isn't true of all cakes.
Oh.
So you can infinitely expand it, and it's white, so it has no egg yolks. It has egg whites in it. So it has butter, but it has no yolks. So it has, a totally white color.
Mm-hmm.
So I used that cake because I wanted to make a lemon balm cake. So I thought it would be a really nice base for infusing that flavor, because it doesn't itself have an overpowering flavor. It just is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like buttery vanilla.
And we have Lemon Balm Hill, I think.
Okay, and that was something. So your garden, Philothea, is full of lemon balm, and it's so beautiful, and it's such a good pollinator attractor, and it just smells so good. And when I saw your garden, that inspired me to put lemon balm around the edges of my garden.
It makes a hedge. It's amazing.
It does.
It's
so beautiful.
Amazing. It's really beautiful. And I think I had talked to you about a lemon verbena cake, but I think you can do it, you know, you obviously can do it with lemon balm too. So, you know.
And right. And anyway, I wonder if the lemon balm keeps the deer out, just as a side, because they, you know, they don't like really aromatic herbs.
Oh, that might be it. Well, that would be a lovely way of keeping deer away.
Yeah,
Jim? Do you know if lemon balm is a deer repellent? Do you know any things that are definitely deer repellent?
Well, they say, you know, people say, you know, if you go online, there's, you know, that the word is that deer don't like, you know, like they don't like sweet alyssum. They don't like strong smelling things, or maybe basil. But, you know, who knows? Maybe they just, they just don't eat that. And then they, you know, stick their head over the lemon balm hedge. I mean, I don't know how it really works.
Oh,
but right now, you know, neither of us have deer fences. And we still have vegetables. So
right, we're out. Yeah. It almost sounds like it's worse in town.
Yeah, it does. I think the deer have more to eat outside of town in the woods. So the lemon balm. Okay, so the other reason. So I was thinking lemon balm cake. Like, that sounds delicious. I have a lot of lemon balm in the garden. I'd been thinking about how to use that. Mm-hmm. And so the white cake in The Joy of Cooking is made with milk as the liquid. So I thought, that would be a good way to infuse the lemon balm. So the recipe uses the milk cold. You don't heat up the milk for the recipe. But for this recipe, I heated up the milk and steeped the lemon balm in the milk and then cooled it back down before I made the cake.
Mm-hmm.
As a way of holding the flavor. And then I, squeezed out the lemon balm once the milk had cooled into the milk to kind of create that flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could also probably just grind up some lemon balm and put it in the batter, but I didn't do that. So I just made
it. You wouldn't have a white cake then.
Then it wouldn't be white, which it doesn't have to be. But
I think there were a little few flecks.
There were a few flecks. I was a little afraid it might make the texture a little gummy if I introduced like a lot of vegetable matter into it.
But you had made a spinach cake. That was a nettle cake.
Yes.
And that didn't turn out gummy, did it?
I would say that cake's a little gummy. Like it's good, but and it's spectacular because it's green and it looks like it has moss on it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I put black caps and lemon curd in it. It was good. But like if I were going to sort of judge the texture at the state fair, it would not win that award. Like it's a little bit too moist.
Oh, okay.
Not moist like a carrot cake. Gummy.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that nettle cake later on, but we're on so this is kind of a lemon balm white cake, and I don't bake cakes, so I am like totally beginner. I have no idea what makes a good cake, but what I did like about your cake is that it was dense. It wasn't fluffy, puffy, and when you think about it, only had egg whites in it. It was not a soft cake. It was really firm, and I loved it. So I don't know what makes, you didn't use cake flour, you said. And cake flour makes more
fluffy
cake?
Well, I think mostly just cake mixes are like that. I think almost any homemade cake isn't going to have that fluffy texture. I don't know what that, super airy is usually some other process or something that's not going to happen.
Some kind of leavening. Well, it's made people expect cake to be soft and puffy, just like our white bread. And really, I mean, cakes can just be really dense and beautiful and tasty, and they don't have to be, just full of holes.
Yeah, so, that lemon balm cake is a pretty standard white cake, and, they're really nice, The base recipe makes 3 8-inch layers or 2 9-inch layers. Those would be equivalent. But I like to make 3 8-inch layers and then cut the layers in half you just use like a really long serrated knife, like a bread knife, and cut those layers in half. And then you can fill each layer. So I used black caps that I got from our woods. I cooked them down a little into a little bit of a jammy or a cobbler type texture, and filled some of the layers with that. And then I made a lemon curd, which is just basically eggs, lemon juice, and sugar. And then some buttercream in the other layers. So then you get a really tall cake.
That's really what's dramatic about it, too. Yeah. It is really pretty. And then it was, we'll talk about the decorations in the end. But let's just talk about how do you start a cake. You're going to cream stuff together. What do you do?
Well, you know, if you just follow a recipe, but you're going to, you know, generally they start with, you know, creaming the butter and sugar. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, easier mm-hmm. if you use a mixer or something like that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going to have very strong mm-hmm. biceps. Use a whisk.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
you want everything to be very well incorporated and creamy in a classic cake, unless it's more of a coffee cake, which is more like a pancake, and those you don't actually mix much.
Mm-hmm.
But a typical layer cake type recipe is some of the lightness of the cake comes from beating it.
Oh, okay.
So usually you start with the butter and sugar, you move on to the eggs. If you're using a recipe where the eggs are separated, so you're beating it, you would beat the yolks into the butter sugar recipe, or in the case of the lemon balm cake, no yolk. And then
do you beat the egg whites separately?
Then often if you're separating the eggs, that means that you're also beating the egg whites separately and into a meringue, essentially. And then you're folding those into the batter at the very end, and that also helps the cake to rise.
Mm-hmm. So when does the flour come in?
So the flour is, so in the cake I made yesterday, you do, you beat the eggs, the sugar, the vanilla, and then you incorporate, you have separately sifted flour, baking powder, salt, and then you've beaten your egg whites. And so, you have your milk. So you incorporate the flour and the milk sort of in thirds into the butter.
Right, okay.
And mm-hmm. then you fold in the egg whites at the end.
Right, okay.
So this just makes sure it all stays light and well mixed. And
right, okay. Yeah. And your flour, you just used an unbleached white flour?
Organic.
Mm-hmm.
Unbleached white flour.
Uh-huh.
From the co-op.
Right. So it wasn't a cake flour. It was just a regular flour.
Yeah, I don't usually... if you made it with cake flour, it would be more fluffy for sure. Like probably if I was making a wedding cake for someone, I'd probably use cake flour.
And what is cake flour?
I think it has some cornstarch in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it
just lightens up that flour a bit.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that. I can't remember anymore how cake flour is made, but it's super light. You know, it has a really obviously different mm-hmm. texture.
Mm-hmm. So then you just poured it into your pans and baked it, and you're just following a recipe. You're saying that recipe was called Lady Baltimore cake?
I think so, yeah. It's a white cake in The Joy of Cooking.
So,
yeah.
And, but one thing that you had mentioned to me, I think on another show, is that be sure to go to an older recipe because they called for less sugar years ago than they do now.
Yeah, the cakes generally have twice as much sugar now as they used to. So it's like really handy if you have some actual cookbooks to look at some older cookbooks and see what the proportions of flour to sugar were. So generally speaking, if you look at older recipes, there's twice as much flour or sort of heavy ingredients like flour as sugar. But nowadays, the recipes have the same proportion of flour and sugar.
Why, do you think? Have we just gotten a taste for sweeter stuff?
Yeah, I think because there's so much sugar tucked into processed foods that people's taste buds are really different. Mm-hmm. So that's happened to ice cream. Like, it's really, you know, I, even though it's a pain, really a lot of trouble to make homemade ice cream, you know, I do it pretty often just because I cannot deal with how much sugar is in the ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true even with, like, you know, the organic brands. They're just really sweet, and it's really hard to find mm-hmm. stuff without, you know, heavy sweeteners like corn syrup. So I think because of that, like, you know, even if you eat, you know, potato chips or something, you know, if, like, you stop
there's it. Sugar they, there's slipped sugar slipped into in everything. Really. Well, one thing I loved about the cake that we got to taste last night is that it wasn't too sweet. And, you know, there were other flavors that you could really enjoy. And, you know, it was sweet enough, but it just, it wasn't overly sweet. And very pleasant texture. And I just loved it. But then the presentation was fabulous. So you get your layers, you get your round, you know, baked cakes out of the oven, and you let them cool, and then you slice them with a serrated knife, and you can make layers, and then you put whatever you want in between, I guess. And you were just sharing that it could be, you know, that was so wonderful to have black caps from the land that was sweet, but it could be, there are lots of different fruits available during the season that you could put in. And then the buttercream frosting, I mean, that can also be super sweet. I don't know, your just proportions were nice. It was sweet enough frosting.
Yeah, frosting's one of the harder things. If you make a real buttercream, which is actually generally made with egg whites, and it's a process. So, like, again, if I made a wedding cake, I'd make a real buttercream, with an Italian meringue. And it's a process. It's a lot of butter, but because it also has a lot of egg whites, and you make a kind of a sugar syrup, it's actually not that sweet. But it's a process to make, and most people wouldn't do it.
No.
But the kind of buttercream you make as a substitute to that is butter and powdered sugar. And there is so much powdered sugar in those frostings in order to create the volume you need to frost a whole cake. So, like, you know, the proportions are astounding. Like, if you use 2 sticks of butter, you might use 1 pound or sometimes 2 pounds of powdered sugar. It's not palatable, in my opinion. You know, it's too sweet. So if I need to make a quick buttercream, I use either mascarpone cheese, which you can get at the co-op, or cream cheese and butter. So last night for that cake, I used like 8 ounces of cream cheese because that's what I had in the house. But mascarpone cheese is better.
And that'll give you more body.
Yes,
what you're saying.
And then I used a stick of butter, and then I probably used maybe 1/2 cup of powdered sugar, like,
oh,
not
really?
That much sugar.
Oh gosh,
maybe less than that. I just poured a little in from the back.
Oh, that was fine.
Just to taste, just until it's sweet.
Oh,
and then I used vanilla and a little bit of heavy cream. So it's.
Mm. So that's not a cooked frosting in any
no,
way.
No, and it's
you
just
don't have to melt a syrup
in the
and
fridge
all
frosting. But if you use some stuff like that, it'll add the volume without having to just use powdered sugar for the volume.
So. Does mascarpone have a sweetener in it? Is it already sweet, or is it just...
It is a slightly sweet cheese, and I don't know how it's made. I mean, it's a really nice dessert ingredient that I haven't inquired too deeply into.
I don't know, but it's lighter than cream cheese.
It is.
It's
sort of like somewhere between, you know, whipped cream and cream cheese, I would say. It's a very nice shortcut for buttercream. So Yeah, I mean, there's ways. That's what I do for the frosting part, to really cut the mm-hmm. sugar and the sweetness mm-hmm. overload of a cake like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I mentioned I make lemon curd. I half the sugar in that, you know, cut that sugar in half. You know, without, you don't even notice that it's mm-hmm. it's not as sweet, because it's lemon curd's kind mm-hmm. of an overwhelming mm-hmm. sweet thing.
Do you put, lemon curd is cooked, right?
Yes.
It's basically egg yolks or the whole egg?
You use a whole egg. Uh-huh. So I think the recipe I used was 4 eggs, maybe a half cup or 3/4 cup. You know, it was like 5 or 6, the juice of 5 or 6 lemons, 5 lemons maybe,
mm-hmm.
A little bit of lemon zest.
And you cook it kind of like a custard.
And I think I put about a half a cup of sugar in there.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then you just cook it for like 5 minutes, whisking it really hard, and, you know, so that it doesn't curdle.
But do you do it in a double boiler or not?
No, I just
cook it. Watch it like...
I just cook it fast. You can cook like baby it and cook it on a double boiler. But you can just cook it on high heat for 5 minutes and whisk it, and then put it through a strainer to get out anything that curdled. Like, do not waste your day on lemon curd. Mm. And you'll still have plenty of lemon curd.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can freeze it, because you'll never need as much as you make usually. So that's
oh,
a good thing.
Oh, great idea.
You know, also with like buttercream frosting, you can freeze that. Also whole cakes. So I used to make wedding cakes, and you generally do have to freeze them. So you often, you know, so if you're assembling a huge cake that's going to take you several days to make, you might make the layers and just freeze them, even if it's only for a day. Sometimes it's easier to handle and ice the cake if it's really, really
right.
cold like
then
that.
Right, then you don't have the crumbs mixing yeah. with the frosting and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so you don't...
Oh, that's a great idea.
You can also, you know, make the entire cake with, you know, the fillings with at least one layer of the buttercream, and then freeze it. So let's say you're transporting it to a wedding and it's July. That is a recipe for disaster. So you have like warm frosting, the cake layers are gonna slide.
Yes.
You know, into the backseat of your car. So if you actually just freeze it even just overnight, then you can transport it, and then mm-hmm. it'll thaw out in a couple hours. So then you sort of, you know, can put it back together where you're putting it.
Wow. How do you transport a cake?
Frozen. Yes. So anyway.
In a box or what? What do you have? I guess there are...
Oh, many boxes. But just the main thing is you can make these things, you know, if you want to get into making tall, pretty cakes, you can, you know, find shortcuts, and you can freeze things for later so mm-hmm. that you don't always, you know, have to make everything all at once.
Right. I asked you if you'd like to bake cakes for a living, and you said, I don't think I could make a living doing it.
Well, I used to, and, yeah. You know, I made $10 an hour, so I'm not very enthusiastic about that.
Oh,
it was a long time ago, but it's not, you know, it's very time consuming, and it's not the kind of thing people want to really pay you that much money for, so you don't get paid for your time. But mm-hmm. it's a really good thing to do
mm-hmm.
out of, you know, for a friend, you know. Mm-hmm. I love to right. make a wedding cake for a friend.
Oh, so now we're getting to frosting the cake. So you put all the layers together, and you did have some buttercream frosting in some of the layers as well as
on the top.
Other fillings. And then you had it on the top and then around the sides.
Yeah, and then I swirled mm-hmm. in a little of the juice from the black cap, so it was sort of a white and purple frosting swirl.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. And then?
And then I love to make cakes when I have a garden, or garden, you know, when I'm making cakes or something like that, because you just have such an array of things you can decorate with.
So what kind of flowers? I mean, everything should be edible, right?
Everything should be edible. And one of the problems with florist flowers, I mean, I think around here in Viroqua, you know, I feel like everybody has a garden, but, you know, I also live in Chicago, and not everybody has a garden, and not everybody has access to seasonal flowers. And, you know, generally speaking, if you use, you know, if you go to like a store and buy flowers, they've got dyed. I'd say less. I mean, you can tell, so you can avoid that easily. But what is on the, what are they sprayed with? And so it's not really recommended to use, you know, florist flowers on a cake.
But what might people have around their house? I mean, violets are almost always poking up someplace. Violets are edible.
Sure, you could use violets.
Marigolds.
Marigolds are edible, and the small, you know, with the bush marigold that has, that sort of grows in a mounded habit, that has the very small blossoms, are considered the edible marigolds, like that they're pleasant to eat. Not only not poisonous, but they have kind of a lemony taste. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really delicate, really pretty on a cake.
Right.
Chamomile flowers I'm using right now are beautiful, and they have that ferny leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Lemon balm leaves, mint leaves.
Calendula?
Are they too big? No, I often use them. I think they're really pretty.
Yeah,
calendula.
That's nice.
Those are beautiful.
One of the things.
Nasturtiums,
plants.
Of course.
Oh,
the leaves,
yes,
the flowers.
Wouldn't they be sweet? And I have the borage just growing everywhere.
Oh, yeah, borage.
And those borage flowers are such a beautiful blue. They are so, so lovely.
And they taste like cucumbers.
Yeah.
So you can eat those.
So you can use a little bit of the leaves, too, like you're saying, some of the ferny leaves of, like, chamomile or...
Yeah, anything that has a beautiful texture like that is great. I'm sure there are other edible flowers that people can think of that would be beautiful decoration. And then I think, you know, even if it's not choice to eat, as long as it's not sprayed with a chemical, it's probably okay to put on there. I mean, you're in fact probably not actually going to eat any of the flowers,
right.
But just thinking about what you're putting on there and whether it has anything that might be
toxic.
Maybe
Queen Anne's lace would be nice. I mean, it's
edible.
It's a carrot.
Yeah.
It's in the carrot family.
I guess we're supposed to be getting rid of it. I think it's pretty, but apparently it's invasive or something.
Oh, dear. Well, it certainly doesn't sting like a poison
parsnip. Yeah, I like
it. Which is just getting to be very invasive.
Yeah, don't put wild parsnip on your on your cake.
No, that would not be good.
Be a bad choice.
You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM and coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin, the Driftless area. You're listening to Who's in the Kitchen, and I'm Philothea Beeson, and I'm talking with Molly Doan. We've been talking about this wonderful wedding cake recipe, step by step. And Molly also had, I saw on Facebook, she had posted a moss cake, which I was totally taken in by. Of course, it would be something you'd like to make for St. Patrick's Day, I guess. But it was, if you really want green, it's very green. And that was just an amazing cake. So let's talk about that cake. Well, Molly is really great about using local things and wild foods and just making it delectable and delicious and beautiful. So, It's fun to hear about people using things that just are growing wild here that you can incorporate into a dessert. So how did you do what was the basis of the moss cake?
So the moss cake, you know, I think of not so much St. Patrick's Day, which I think of as a drinking holiday, Philothea. I think of it as a celebration of spring of the first greens that are coming up, like the nettles. And so, you know, nettles are I think traditionally a really important food in the spring because they come up early and, you know.
They're very cleansing.
They're cleansing and they're full of minerals that if, you know, you had, you know, hundreds of years ago even when we had more seasonal local food, maybe you were kind of lacking in some minerals by spring. The nettles, you know, really revitalize you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the moss cake is, I put it in that category of really celebrating
a spring cake.
The spring mm-hmm. and everything that's coming up.
So I'm trying to imagine how you incorporate the nettles in. What are you doing? You have a batter that you're going to add. How do you bring the nettles in?
So the moss cake, you could just Google it and find a bunch of versions of that and see what looks. Mm-hmm. They're all about the same, you know.
So is that basically a cake with the whole eggs in it?
Or that cake it's a pretty simple cake with whole eggs, flour, butter, and instead of a liquid like a milk or a juice or whatever liquid the cake might have had, what you're substituting is a nettles puree. So it's a cake where you would mix the butter and the sugar and the eggs, and then you would incorporate the flour mixture and the nettles puree in thirds so that the mm-hmm. cake doesn't get too heavy or mm-hmm. like the to make it less gummy, you should incorporate all those things in thirds. Mm-hmm. That helps with the texture a lot with this cake.
So how do you prepare that puree?
So the puree, I'd say fill about a brown grocery bag full of nettles in the spring when they're small. And, excuse me, and then you... you de-stem them. So wear your gloves and de-stem them. And
the stems are really fibrous.
Yes.
So you just want
the leaves. You just want the leaves.
Okay.
And put all those leaves in boiling water for a minute or two until they're kind of a cooked spinach texture. And then pull them out and put them in ice water. And that... The process of cooking and cooling them gives the nettles a really bright green color that if you
cooked them too long, they'd be army brown, wouldn't they?
Yes, and if you, and I've experimented with this, because I actually eat nettles in smoothies, because when you puree nettles raw, they don't sting. The stingers are gone. So I substitute nettles for any other green in like a green smoothie in the morning. But if you just make a raw nettles puree, it's not as bright of a green. So it's not terrible, but it's got a little more brown to it. But if you do this, you sort of blanch them, I guess. If you blanch them and then you cool them down to stop their cooking, they're really a vibrant green. And then, so that would be a better way to use them if you want that, like, to make a food coloring out of them also, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend that. So then you puree that cooked, cooled nettles mixture, and you basically want it...
In a blender. Blender? Okay.
And then you want it... end up with 2 cups of pure nettles puree that is, I'm trying to think of what the consistency should be like. But, you know, it's a liquid, but
it's not watery, liquid. It's thick.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that becomes, you know, one of your main ingredients in this cake. And the cake, it's a huge recipe, and so you get two you could get 3 8-inch layers or 2 9-inch layers, plus it makes a little extra batter that you can put into any other kind of cake pan that you have available. So you cook the layers, and then you let them cool, and then the little extra layer you crumble into just cake crumbs. And then you assemble your, so you make, you know, any kind of buttercream or frosting, whatever frosting you want for this cake. Assemble it so that you have a layer cake, frost it, and then you put those cake crumbles all over the cake, and they're bright green and they look just like moss. I mean, it's really amazing.
I was amazed when I saw that picture.
Yeah. And then the layers are green also. So when you cut into the cake, it's, you know, got green layers with whatever filling you put in.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually then put, like, when I made that cake last time in the spring, I think we had lilac blossoms and maybe, I don't know, catnip flowers or something. But, you know, I just put flowers on the top of that also, mm-hmm, with the moss, and that makes it really, really pretty, especially purple and green is really nice on that cake.
Yeah. And so did it taste like nettles, or does it just,
no,
the nettle taste just
so it,
disappears?
The cake kind of also has a lot of lemon juice in it.
Did you say you put lemon curd on those layers or not?
I did put lemon curd, yeah, in those layers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. But the cake itself has lemon juice and lemon zest, and so it's essentially a lemon cake with that has, mm-hmm, nettles, so that you don't taste the nettles.
Mm-hmm.
You just it eats like a lemon layer cake.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you can look up a moss cake on the internet and see the pictures. I mean, they're just really amazing. My husband made up a spinach beignet, and we did them with spinach, but we probably also did them with nettles, and made beignet and fried them, yep, you know, like a donut, and they were delicious. That was really fun to serve green donuts.
Yeah. Well, the nettles are great. I mean, I have totally stopped growing spinach.
I know.
Because it's such a pain.
I know.
And then it
it's
doesn't last
It's a short season.
Long. Yeah.
And, yeah, but I don't think you're supposed to eat nettles after they get really kind of rank. I think they're best when they're young. When they're,
yeah,
young.
I think for the cake it matters less, because it's, mm-hmm, really a food, mm-hmm, coloring in there.
But I eat nettles later on in the season if they're just the tops, kind of. I keep on eating them. But I think they might change somewhat in their food value or something as they get more rank and older.
Oh, maybe they do. I've also made, when I was cutting, you know, I love the nettles, but not always everywhere, you know, so I've been leaving them in what used to be a horse pasture that we're sort of transitioning to, mm-hmm, to wildflower meadow, but there's nettles there, so, but right around my garden, I've been kind of bushwhacking those,
mm-hmm,
so I eat those, mm-hmm, and then, I also made a nettles compost tea, so I'm going to use that to fertilize my garden when it looks like it needs to be fertilized,
mm-hmm,
which is not right now.
Not right now, because you practically grew it over horse manure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your garden. It really is very, very lovely. And, you know, I came over, and it's you have raised beds, which is really a nice way to start, because you really, you know, have a head start on all the weeds. And it's a lot of work to fill a raised bed with soil. I know you had truckloads of it, and then you had to shovel it. So that was a lot of work. But now when you go over and see the garden, it's really quite spectacular. But what you were doing, you had all these strings. So explain what you were doing over there with all those strings and sticks.
Well, yeah, and I don't know if I would necessarily do raised beds. I mean, you have to weed no matter what, because, you know, weeds reseed. And
mm-hmm.
But when we bought the place, it had a big raised bed, which hadn't been used in years, and so grass had, like, you know, that quack grass had grown over it. But I realized that the grass had grown over a landscape fabric covering the raised bed, so I just ripped all the grass, you know, the landscape fabric off, and it pulled the grass out.
Oh, how nice.
So we had this raised bed, and it still is mostly clay. I mean, it's mostly just...
That was just regular soil from the land.
Yeah, I mean, it's just soil probably that came out of the pole shed when they built it, you know, when they were excavating.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not, like, special dirt. But it was already there, and so we ended up building another really big, long bed like it just because... We'd already started that one, and symmetry and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have kind of a really long... so we have a... I think the raised beds are about maybe 60 feet long now and, you know, 20 feet wide or something. It's kind of like a really long row. And we're going to build another one... that's next to it, equal in size, basically. So it'll be more like 40 by 60.
Kind of separating the annuals from the perennials.
We'll just have more room for everything. I feel like
You wanted to have your strawberries separate from the garden.
I just want to have, like, wider pathways and more room for things like herbs like chamomile that... You really want to harvest a lot of it if you're going to bother with it, you know, if you're going to make tea or something with that.
Mm-hmm.
So just expanding what we have. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we had to fill it with, because the garden kind of goes downhill. My husband kind of terraced it up, and then it had to be filled. So we had
a pretty deep. It was pretty
catastrophe
deep.
Where the... The dirt got delivered after it had rained a lot, and the truck sunk into the ground, and the guy had to dump the dirt outside of the garden. And so we had this horrible situation where we had, you know, like 10 yards of dirt really close to the garden, but not in it. And so, you know, I had to fill a lot of wheelbarrows, and our visitors had to fill a lot of wheelbarrows and get that dirt. And so that set us back a little. Starting,
but I think it really, because I have some of the same plants in my garden, and things that were coming up in your garden were really, you could tell the soil was really better than this more compacted clay that I have that I grow stuff in. But so tell us about your little garden design plan. I thought that was so cute.
So I like doing these. I like doing something like, I don't know what it's called, like decorative forest kitchen gardens. So, you know, basically the main principle being some permaculture of some sort or agroforestry of some sort, so that the garden itself is very close to or surrounded by trees. So bushes and trees and wildflowers surrounding and around the garden, you know, and not too far from big trees as well. I think, you know, sort of mimic, so that you have all the sort of natural cycles happening in your garden and a good ecosystem to control the insects and bring in the birds. So I'm doing that so that the garden is surrounded by... a natural ecology.
Okay, so this wasn't just for beauty.
No,
but you are doing a design, and you're thinking,
but then
what
within
to surround
the garden
and protect.
Yeah, so it's so there's sort of one scale, sort of outside the garden, where I'm trying to make sure there's healthy sort of wildflowers, shrubs, and trees, and then within the garden, so that raised bed part I was talking about. I'm also doing sort of a smaller scale version of that. So I grow a lot of high-growing dill you know, that's sort of like a flower canopy. And then a lot of, and stuff like catnip bushes, which are amazing for bumblebees, and tomatillos, which I love eating, but they also are like, bring in the bumblebees like nothing else I've ever seen. And then low-growing flowers like sweet white alyssum that are supposed to repel deer. They attract pollinators. And I use the alyssum to essentially delineate. I don't plant in rows. I plant in sort of big squares usually. So let's say I have a 4x4 square, and inside that there might be 6 or 8 cabbages or something like that, or 5 eggplants. That is outlined with alyssum plants that I plant like as little plugs 8 inches apart. So I grow those. I have a little greenhouse and I grow that stuff as much as possible, because otherwise I would be
bankrupt.
Well,
you used hundreds. Hundreds of plants.
Well,
really.
Thousands of flowers, actually, yeah. So
and then
so I
between,
do a design.
Yeah.
I make a design with string that is maybe like some kind of a quilt pattern or whatever, and incorporates pathways and then these sort of discrete 4x4 planting areas.
Mm-hmm. And the pathways are really small,
triangles.
Like about 2.
Yeah, some are triangles that are kind of like half of the square.
So they're not really wide pathways, but they're enough to step in. So
yeah,
you're
they're
not
enough
stepping
to,
on your
to
plants.
Get around your beds so that
right,
you
right, if
can,
you're a 16-foot bed or whatever, 20,
so you
20
can
by
inspect, yeah. You know, so mm-hmm. they can pick off all the cabbage lopers. You know, I spend most of my day picking off cabbage lopers and cucumber beetles and Japanese beetles and washing off eggs and just trying to, even though I know, you know, the birds are also helping with that, but not always enough. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. So birds are helping with the insects.
They are definitely in there eating a lot of things.
Interesting.
Yeah, we have some Baltimore Orioles that are in there a lot. We have robins, and we have barn swallows that seem... I'm not sure what they're all eating.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who knows about birds would know that. But
mm-hmm.
Those are the ones I notice the most.
Yeah,
in my garden.
Yeah. Well, you have lots of flowers, lots of calendula. That's beautiful. What are some of the things that are good repellents then? So you said alyssum is.
Alyssum is supposed to be a deer repellent,
mm-hmm.
but who knows, you know.
Or
like
companion things. Do you
yeah. So those, like? And the dill brings in parasitic wasps, which are supposed to eat caterpillars like that are on your cabbage. They also are eating the swallowtail caterpillars, unfortunately, which is something that dill is a good host for. So, you know, there's all kinds of
wow,
things going on.
All kinds of balances. And, yeah, you start realizing this is very complex.
So I grow the dill, like, in the middle. Like, if I have a bunch of, like, a 4x4
mm-hmm.
square that's delineate outlined by alyssum, mm-hmm. and inside it I have a bunch of cabbage or kale, which is I grow a lot of that lacinato or dinosaur kale. It's so pretty. It's kind of blue. And say I have, I don't know, 8 of those in a square. In the middle I'll put a bunch of dill, and it grows really tall, you know, into kind of like a top canopy. And I love the way that looks.
Mm-hmm.
Those grow together really well. You know, nothing is, you know, that it's not preventing the kale from reaching its
mm-hmm.
Maturity or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, attracts a lot of pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, use the dill. I love dill. I mean, mm-hmm. I have way more dill than I could ever eat in a million years.
Right.
That's just
it's
a plant
wonderful.
I love,
I mean, yeah,
and it
self-seeds. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. in the spring, I just move it around to where I want it. And then, you know, take out what I don't want. And then I use a lot of calendula in the corners, sort of outside of the pattern, because they make huge sort of flower bushes, and they also self-seed, so you only need to plant that once in your life, and then you can move it around in the spring mm-hmm. to where you want mm-hmm. it. So
I just like to mention that Molly she really does gardening, and community gardening is part of her career, her real love, and her way of teaching and so forth in Rogers Park and in Chicago area.
Right? Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what you do there. I mean, you're instructing people and helping people to work on community gardens.
Yeah, I manage a community garden in Chicago, and one of the things I do there is I don't have my own garden in that garden. I don't need it. But we have built these, my husband built 6 raised beds that go along the outside of the garden. So the garden has a fence that, and it's locked, unfortunately, but that's necessary. And outside of the garden on the parkway, which is sort of between the street and the sidewalk, we've built these 6 raised beds. We build them really high so that they're wheelchair accessible and dog pee inaccessible.
Okay.
And then we plant those, and those are food that anyone can take. So it sort of encourages people to take food and instead of climbing the fence and stealing food from gardeners, to take food that's freely given, and it's sort of beautifying, and people really like it.
Oh, that's wonderful!
That it's there.
So
we just
give to the community.
We try to plant stuff that doesn't need too much care. Like tomatillos are a good choice.
Zucchini?
They don't need to be babied.
Do you do squashes?
I don't, because we have such a bad squash bug problem in the garden. With the community gardens, you can get really bad. It's really hard to control pests because not every single gardener is doing it. And so I've stopped growing squash entirely in our beds. But, you know, I grow a lot of herbs. I grow some tomatoes, especially cherry tomatoes. They're easy for people to take. A lot of herbs like basil. I grow a lot of collard greens because it's a mostly black neighborhood, so it's a food people eat, like, recognize. I grow okra for the same reason. I don't know, I grow parsley, just, you know, things that are dill. Anything that's that I've noticed that people will take,
mm-hmm.
and that also are pretty tough, because those parkway beds don't get watered as regularly as I would like.
How do you water them? Gosh.
Well, I water them when I'm there, and people from the garden water them, but you know, sometimes, you know, it's really...
You can get hoses out there? Or
yeah, you
just
have to
buckets?
Drag hoses out there. It's a pain.
Yeah.
It's a pain to water them. So, mm-hmm. you know, they get watered when they get watered.
Mm. But you are also mentoring other people in the city who are making community gardens?
I work with students and I teach classes about food and the environment and the relationship between those two things, increasingly, teaching about gardening and urban gardening. And so through that, I'm involved in a broader community that I'm bringing to my students. So, mm-hmm. you know, we visit urban farms and other urban gardens and community gardens in my classes.
I think that's just so exciting, because I've just never really urban gardening could be like, and it's wonderful that people are having the opportunity to see those gardens and participate in them in the city.
Yeah, they're really important for people, for just for happiness. to have a little fresh food to connect to
your own culture
yeah, and heritage
right.
foods.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for community. I mean, you really do meet people and know people in a certain way in the garden. And even if you just wave to another gardener in the garden, then when you see them outside of the garden, you say hi to them there. And it kind of starts to build these relationships
yeah.
that then transcend the garden. Mm-hmm. And so that's really important. And then they're a place you can use to do community events.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a website connected with that? I know you had an installation at the museum.
Yeah, I did at the Field Museum.
At the Field Museum. Yeah. Is there any way to see your work online?
You know, I really need to do a website, but I just really can't focus on it ever. 'Cause as soon as, you know...
As soon as it's gardening time.
As soon as it's gardening season, you know, is followed by intense teaching season, is followed by mm-hmm. seed catalogs, starting seeds. And the website's just not happening.
Yeah. And there's always the
I do have
yeah,
one.
Yeah, there's
at
the
USC.
Harvesting and the preserving of food and then the making and the food and the recipes.
Yeah, that's what
and,
I'm really.
Yeah, that's what
know,
you
that's
really
what
love.
I like doing. Yeah. If you look at. My name's Molly Doan, and if you look, it's Doane. And if you Google me, I have a web page at the University of Illinois website. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can mm-hmm. You can see various things. But I'd love to get, you know, together a website that just brings together all of the gardening projects.
Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful.
It would be nice.
To access. But I know that kind of stuff takes a lot of time.
I just can't keep it at the top, you know, the front burner, you know, speaking of
especially
the kitchen
while you're remodeling a house, and that's taking a lot of time. So I've been talking with Molly Doan. I have the fortune to be her next door neighbor, which is a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot from Molly, and I get to benefit from her wonderful cooking and recipes. She's just inventive and doing so many things. So thank you so much for tuning in to Who's in the Kitchen. I hope you have a wonderful day, and tune in next week at noon on Saturday. We'll have another show about food. And I'm Philothea Beeson. Have a great day.